Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. It's October 23rd, 2012. I'm your host, Jeff Sakarik of thesuperfitvegan.com, along with co-host Megan the Vegan Wilmore of Facebook fame. And today we're going to, this is the show where we talk about all things related to the vegan lifestyle and developing a high level of physical fitness. Last week we talked quite a bit about sandal-clad running, which I enjoy. As a matter of fact, I did a long run today in flip-flops. So we can continue on that vein a little bit. We're going to get off to a couple other topics. We also talked about the benefits of doing in-home workouts, equipment-free workouts last week. And then we ended the show on the topic why people consider some fellow beings food rather than others. So we'll get into that at the top of the show here. And then if we've got time, I want to get into Mike Adams' Natural News piece, Everything is Rigged, Health, Politics, Finance, and More, but Here's How to Beat the System. A pretty well put together piece by Mike Adams. We'll also take callers, so if you've got a comment, a story, or a personal situation that has to do with the vegan lifestyle, or your own level of physical fitness, or anything that's relative to what we're talking about, give us a call at 718-664-6436, and we'll be happy to take your call. How are you doing, Ruthann? Are you there?
I am good. I'm having a spring rain in autumn, so or spring storm in autumn.
It's 70 degrees, too. That's Indian summer. Indian summer in the Midwest, you can't beat it.
That's right. It's beautiful. It smells good, too.
Are you there? Are you there, Megan, in Australia?
Hello, I'm here.
All right.
Can I ask, firstly, what is an Indian summer?
What
does that term mean?
Why don't you answer that, Ruthann?
Okay. To me, it usually is in September, but I guess October works. It's like the last couple weeks. You may have had summer, and then it's gotten cooler. Then you have this burst of beauty when the trees change and it warms up a little bit, and that's Indian summer. Somebody may have a better definition, but to me that's the one that works. So it's usually a couple weeks.
Yeah, I'm not sure where the term Indian summer came from, but basically it's referring to kind of the last splurge, or the last, in the Midwest, the last gasp of summer right before the cool weather comes in.
Right, before the cool,
for winter.
Yeah. So
exactly right. And it's a beautiful time of year.
Mm-hmm.
My parents have a cabin on a lake up in Michigan, and there are people just from all over the world that go out there to see the trees change and the weather, and it's really nice to be there.
Yeah.
Also,
the leaves. That's something that a lot of places don't have, such pronounced change of season like we do here. It's more subtle other places, I think. So it's pretty special, yeah.
It really is. That's one of the things. Also, it's a great time to work out outdoors.
Mm.
Probably the best time of the year to go out for a run. And, you can also get a good workout raking all of those leaves. That's harder than it looks.
It is.
Get out there. It looks like it should be easy, but when by the time you get done doing that a few hours with that rake and those bags, you find out all that twisting, turning, not a bad workout. It's kind of like a weird form of yoga that I recommend in addition to your runs and your calisthenic workouts.
Yeah.
And if you've got children, you could turn it into a fun family event.
Oh, sure.
You certainly could. Yeah, only could. You might have to give them some type of reward when it's over to keep them going. But I remember when I was a kid, my brother used to do, you know, we would have to do the leaf raking. And, yeah, that can be a heck of a workout when you're a kid.
It's also okay if you do just leave them on the ground. But don't forget to compost them. Don't let the city take them away. Yeah. Compost them if you can.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. Just to finish off with the sandal plaid running issue that we were talking about last week, Megan and I were both remarking on the fact that I'll never go back to a standard running shoe just because of, well, I've been doing the minimalist shoe running, first in Vibrams, now in homemade sandals. I've been doing that for a couple of years now. And I was talking to Megan today. I think now, after reading marathoner Ken Bob Saxton's book, which is a great one, Barefoot Running Step by Step, after having read that book a couple of years ago and adopting this form of running, I'm not sure that I could go back to a standard style, even if I wanted to.
No, you wouldn't be able to.
Probably not. I've grown accustomed to the efficient, shorter steps, kind of a controlled lean of it where you lean forward and use gravity, and it's almost like your arms and legs are kind of just along for the ride.
This is the way humans are meant to run. This is the way we're meant to run. So to go back to the other style would be going against, you know, the way it's meant to be. So you're running correctly, and yeah.
I agree, and it really is. When you get into it, it's like taking a cast off of your foot, and it doesn't. It never really occurred to me earlier in my athletic days that why would it? I was just a kid, didn't know any better, didn't know anything about the Tarahumara Indians or the book Born to Run, anything like that, and all I ever knew was the sneakers. So it didn't really occur to me that, yes, you've got 30-plus muscles, tendons, ligaments in your foot, and if they're constantly padded and babied with these new heavily padded athletic shoes, which are only have only come into favor in the last, Nike, 25 years or so?
It might
be less than that, because before that, you had just racing flats and very pretty minimalistic footwear. All this heavy padded stuff is a fairly new thing and a rather failed experiment. McDougall, in that book we're talking about, Born to Run, cites a couple of good studies, and they appear to be fairly reliable from what I have looked at. And they show clearly that the more padding in a shoe, the higher rate of injury. And my theory on that is the fact that if you've got a lot of padding in that shoe, it lets you get away with things that your body should not be able to get away with. Landing on the heel first, having one foot drag behind the other, you can't get away with that stuff if you do not have a heavily padded shoe. Wouldn't you agree, Megan?
Yeah, well, the old style shoes completely change the way you run. Running, and especially running in sandals. I said last week that it was so intense, and again this week, yes, I agree wholeheartedly. they're the most intense thing to wear. The workout you get is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it feels right because you are running the way you're meant to run. So, yeah, there's so many benefits to it.
I think it feels right because you're engaging. It really does force you to engage your entire core at a deeper level. If you can kind of picture your body swiveling on an axis as it's slightly leaning forward, there's a lot more core action when you're doing it the right way.
You use every muscle in your body, basically. Like, I feel it, my whole body. I just feel that I'm working muscles, you know, that in running that I've never used before. And, yeah, it's just such an intense workout.
All of that being said, I have to say that I was Whenever I see a new angle on the minimalist shoe or the sandal running or barefoot running, I'm always game to try something new. And I could not, a couple people on Facebook sent me the link to the gentleman, I can't remember his first name, last name, Levasseur, who he did the 100-mile Leadville race in shoes, and he just ran the Baltimore Marathon in a sub-3-hour time in a pair of flip-flops. I don't know what type of flip-flops they were, but after having read that, I was like, all right, I've got to go out there and get a pair. So I went ahead and got a pair of those cheap flip-flops. I think the things had almost too much padding. I wasn't used to it, so it didn't feel right to me. And then I got the kind with a plastic strap that kept digging into my skin. So I went out for a – I wanted to make a 2-hour run today, but I stopped an hour into it because of that that strap eating in, drawing blood on my skin. So the flip-flops, I didn't like them so far. I may try a cloth pair. They've got a couple cloth pairs over at the mall here in the Philippines where I'm at. And I may pick up a pair of those, and I'll try it this week and report back on my results on next week's show.
Can I say, though, that, one, the thongs that you purchased were only, as you mentioned, $2, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I've run in thongs before, which you call flip-flops, but I've run in them before, not long distances. And I haven't had any issues, and I wear them all the time. One, you haven't worn them before. But two, the cheaper the thong, it's almost like, yeah, they're harder. They're not as pliable. I've got, what's the brand? Oh, a popular brand anyway, and they're thinner on the bottom, and the rubber, they're actual rubber. So they're quite pliable, and the strap across the top isn't as firm as what yours looked like. So, yes, my thongs are probably 10 times the cost of yours, but I don't ever have issues wearing them.
All right. That sounds like a plan of attack. I'll have to go over to the mall, and what I'll do is I'll bring my iPhone, and they've got free Wi-Fi at the mall, so I'll have you go shopping with me for a good pair, and then we'll report back on the results.
Yeah, Havanas. They're a really popular brand, but they're just so comfortable. I mean, that's all I wore, you know, when I was over in Thailand and the Philippines. That's all I ever wear.
Sounds like a good idea. So I will bring you with me shopping on the iPhone. We'll pick out a pair, and I'll try those out. I'm excited to do it, though, because whenever you read a story like that, yeah, I'm not sure what type of flip-flops this guy used to run the Baltimore Marathon. It is an interesting story, though. He did mention that there were people looking at him going, man, what in the heck are you doing? And from what I understand, the Guinness Book of World Records did not have anybody that had run a marathon in flip-flops. So by default, he was the fastest to do it. But it's pretty impressive that he did it in a sub-3-hour. I think it was 2:46 that he ran it in. I don't think he would have made it if he would have had the type of cheap straps that I've got on mine here. So, yeah, I think you're right. I'll look for a more comfortable pair this week, and we'll give it a shot.
Jeff, also, don't forget, you bought them when? This morning or yesterday afternoon?
Mm-hmm.
But they're brand new. They're as stiff as boards. The thongs, when I watched that video, the thongs he was wearing looked like they were well-worn. They were molded to his foot. So you've also got to take that into consideration, that he's not just going to go out and buy a brand new pair of thongs and run a marathon in them.
That's a possibility. I did not see on the video how old his were. He did mention that he had previously run the newscaster asked him, well, what's the longest that you've run in these things prior to this marathon? I think he said it was a 14-mile run that he went on them. So the answer is, yeah, he probably had those things broken in from that 14-miler fairly well.
I mean, it's like any pair of shoes, which you don't wear anymore, but if you remember when you did wear shoes, the first couple of weeks or months, they're excruciating.
And no matter how many times you broke in a plastic strapped one, I'm not sure that would mold that well to your foot. But we'll experiment with it this week. I'll probably pick up a cloth pair and we'll give that a shot.
Yeah, the ones I've got are rubber, so it probably would make a difference. But don't forget, you're used to just wearing sandals anyway, so having something completely different on your foot, it's going to take a while to adjust to.
Yeah, and these things are a lot more padding, so it is kind of strange when my normal sandal that I run in is probably less than a millimeter of rubber for the sole.
Yeah.
And these sandals had about triple that amount of padding.
Yeah. It's almost like you're going, by wearing the thongs, you're almost going backwards because you've gotten to the point where the next step up is just barefoot. So the thongs, they hang from your foot. They're only secured like in that one point between your toes. The heel part is dangling, like you said, you can hear yourself running. So to me, it just seems that that's a step back.
Yeah, it's a step back in the sense that there's a lot more padding on these. So again, it allows you to do things and changes your gait. It changes your gait.
Yes.
From what it was before.
And also, I think you'd be clenching your toes too. Well, that's what I noticed when I'd run in them. You do have to clench your toes slightly because you feel as if the thong's going to fly off your foot. So it would change your form and technique slightly.
That didn't happen with these because I probably got a pair that were too tight to begin with. So they were fairly secure.
Yeah.
But we'll go with a cloth pair this week and then... See how that.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't hurt trying something new out. I think that's great. But I just, you run in sandals, and I think that is the ultimate point that you want to get to.
Yeah. And there's no going back now because I've been doing it for a couple of years and totally satisfied with it. The longest I've run in just the sandals is about 30 miles. And, a lot of that was up one hill 15 and back downhill another 15. And
I can never work out the miles because I think in kilometres. So I don't know if it's almost double or whether that's like 50 k's. I'm not sure off the top of my head.
I'd have to look that one up.
Anyway.
All right, so let's go ahead and move on from the sandal running. We were talking last week at the end of the show about... the idea that, I'm not sure how we got off onto the topic, but just the idea that some people consider some fellow beings food and other ones as friends. You know, what's the difference between eating a slab of bacon or a pig, which is very close to a human being in terms of how it's put together, and not eating a dog. It seems to be splitting hairs in a way that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. So we ended on that topic last week, and of course, Megan and I have been Ruth Ann fans of Melanie Joy's work. If you go onto YouTube and you watch her hour-long speech on carnism, you can find it on YouTube for free. To me, that's one of the best speeches that I have ever heard in any genre, irregardless of genre. And she's been looking at this topic since she was in graduate school. She's been looking at this individual topic for about a decade now. And most of her detractors who don't like what she does have looked at the topic for about 10 minutes. So that tells you quite a bit right there, and if you have not seen that speech, it is well worth watching, and it has to do with why humans consider some animals acceptable fare for the dinner table and other ones not. And Megan, you had something to say about that you ran across today. What is that? Megan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There.
I just need a minute. I've got an issue at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, so now, Ruthann, have you seen that Dr. Joy's, I'm not sure if she was a doctor, Melanie Joy's video, the one on YouTube that I'm talking about?
No, I haven't, and I wanted you to give the name, her name, and its name again, please.
Now, let me look it up real quick here. It's Melanie Joy. And the, Melanie Joy, and it is on YouTube. Let me get the exact title of it so we can give it out.
Okay. I think that sounds very worth watching and sharing.
I'm back here.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and give Ruthann the Melanie Joy's speech on YouTube, the one that we watched over in Thailand. Melanie Joy, Carnism, the Psychology of Eating Meat. Melanie Joy, J-O-Y, Carnism, the Psychology of Eating Meat. And she does just a really, really phenomenal job in that video breaking the entire subject matter down. She knows her facts like the back of her hand. And she starts that video off by describing just the massive chasm between what people think goes into their animal food production and what the actuality is. For example, many people don't realize that 19,000 land animals in the U.S. alone are killed every minute for food. And she goes into the massive amount of animals in comparison to the human population that are killed every day. And it's a huge, huge number. You can get it all the details on her video.
I'm going to watch it.
And the point of it, it's great. The point of it is that, you never see these animals because these corporations and food producers make absolutely sure that the public does not see what's going on. I know this from a firsthand standpoint because I used to, for a period of time after I was a fisherman in Alaska for years, which I wouldn't do now. This was back when I didn't know any better. After that, I delivered telephone books in the U.S., which you used to be able to make a ton of money in. I did that for a few years, and I delivered the Tyson chicken plants. I remember it very vividly in Arkansas on a job that I did. Me and another guy were wheeling these pallets into the Tyson chicken plants, and they made very, very sure that we could not see anything. But you know what? They couldn't. We heard what was going on in there.
Oh, God.
And it's like it's a horror story. It's a true life horror story. And anyway, the point is, if you watch that Melanie Joy video, Carnism, she gives a lot of the details in this that people just aren't aware of. So she does a good job of breaking what I would call the cognitive dissonance. Which is another way of saying that if you're talking to people about this information that are meat and potato eaters, they've never heard it before, when you start reciting some of the facts surrounding this issue, they'll just look at you with a completely dumb, blank stare, because obviously 19,000 land animals being killed each minute has nothing to do with football or basketball or Dancing with the Stars, so de facto it's not important.
Right.
Okay, Megan, you're back? Are you back, Megan?
Yes, sorry, I have a dog.
No problem. Okay, and you were doing a little bit of work on this today, a little bit of research, and what did you find?
Okay, I came across the website. www.carnism.com. One that I had seen for not sort of really interesting. One that should be looked at by everyone.
It sounds like you're a little bit far away. Try turning off your speaker and then turn
it. No, I don't have it. It's not doing it now. I don't have the speaker.
Okay.
It's flat. So
now you sound better. Okay. Give me the website address again. Is it carnism.com?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'm on it now.
It's the Carnism Awareness Action Network.
Got it.
Okay, so I'm just going to read a little bit about what is carnism, just a brief description. Carnism, invisible belief system or ideology that conditions people to speak certain attitudes. Carnism is essentially the opposite of egoism. Can't move flesh or of the flesh and doesn't know a belief system. Most people view eating animals as a given rather than a choice. In meat-eating cultures around the world, people typically don't think about why they find the flesh of some animals disgusting and the flesh of other animals appetizing, or why they eat any animals at all. But when eating animals is not a necessity of survival, as is the case in much of the world today, it is a choice, and a choice is always based on a belief. So then there's more that goes into recognizing different beliefs, why carnism hasn't been named until now. I won't go into that. There's another book that I like to read, which is the importance of understanding carnism as non-vegan, which for the majority of us began life as non-vegan. Most of us who have grown up with animals don't realize time to sit down to a field. We are acting according to an invisible belief system that shapes our thoughts, preferences, feelings, and behaviors. We aren't aware of how different conditions to the animals without considering the implications of our choices on ourselves or on others, or to even realize who we're making choices at all. This invisible belief system, carnism, has created the illusion of when we eat animals, we are making that choice freely. But carnism is structured to enable humane people to participate in humane practices without realizing what they are doing, to block our events so that we unknowingly act with their own interests and the interests of others. And then it got into how carnism has impacted you as well. It's so informative. It would be great. I'll post it on my Facebook, hopefully it'll get out there and have more pets than you. So.
Now, as you're talking here, I'm just going through the website here, and I liked the information that they have, the carousel going across the top of the
with the
different quotes. Carnism. I'm looking at it right now. Carnism.com. Carnism requires a denial of our basic humanity. Masterfully defines a new paradigm with which to view our society and empowers us to understand why we believe what we believe. And all of these are, to my way of thinking, very important. And it goes, of course, they're very important for animals and humans alike, for what we're putting in our mouths, how we're affecting our health, and how we're affecting these fellow creatures. Yet it also, when you get into this, when you start looking at the issue, which was not one that interested me when I became a vegan 20 years ago, I didn't care. I got into it for athletic reasons, for personal health reasons. At the time, I could not have cared less about this issue. What happens is the more that you're exposed to it, and I was exposed to it in the right way, with the right triggers and the right educators like Melanie Joy, that hit upon something in an intelligent way that affected me deeply. And that was her identification of what Megan was just talking about. The fact that this is a belief system that's adopted, almost hoisted upon humanity at an early age en masse, and then just subconsciously it's just accepted by the masses and it's just brushed away to the side, and 19,000 land animals killed every minute in one country. What does that got to do with me? Pass me another burger. And you know, you start looking at that issue and how it strikes me when I go through grocery stores here in the Philippines where I'm at, where you'll see, for example, on a carton of fish sticks, a cartoon of a fish with a happy face holding up fish sticks. When I walk through the mall here, I see Ronald and I see the indigenous people here photographing their children next to Ronald holding up a hamburger. Instead, he should be holding up a blood dripping carcass. And so the point of this is that there is a massive chasm or discrepancy between what it actually takes to get these items of food, if you want to call them that, onto your plate, and what is shown to humanity at a very young age across the board as what that is. You know, when a child looks at the marketing of these meat and dairy companies, their nervous systems at an early age link that that's something good. It's something happy. And, of course, it doesn't help that these foods are massively addictive. And so the conditioning starts at an early age, and this all started, as we talked a little bit about last week, when very little was known about vitamins, nutrition, the effect of certain foods on the effect of animal proteins on the human body in the late 50s, early 60s. Well, that's when the meat and dairy industries made damn sure that they instituted the four food groups and lobbied or bribed your elected public servants to institute the four food groups and teach everybody that you couldn't get along without a ton of protein in meat and dairy, because they knew that was the one thing, outside of a lot of fat and cartilage and hormones and a lot of other terrifying ingredients, the one thing that they could push upon the public was that these things were high in protein. Well, come to find out that not only don't you need very much protein as a human, most official organizations say it's about 6 to 10%. I agree with that. But we find out now that the animal protein is highly acidic and that humans are designed to thrive on an alkaline environment. So the very protein, animal protein that people are consuming is the very stuff that's tearing them apart physically. And what do you know? As animal protein consumption has gone up in countries, those are the exact countries that suffer the highest rates of cancer, heart disease, and other degenerative diseases. So the point of all this, when it's all said and done, is that there's just a big chasm, even still now, with all these people going vegan. James Cameron's a vegan. You give him a pat on the back. Pink is a vegan. I don't know how much of this is a publicity stunt by a lot of these people and how much is actual reality. Of course, I'm glad they're getting the word out in whatever way that they can. But when it's all said and done, the point of it is that there's still, even with all these celebrities and people going vegan, there's still a massive chasm between what people are putting into their bodies and what they think is the right thing to do. So they're taught in their nervous systems at an early age to link pleasure and not pain through imagery to these animals that they're consuming. You know, instead of looking at these cartoons, they should be looking at, as early as possible, I think, a film like Earthlings, or at the very least, Food, Inc.
Mm-hmm. The disconnect.
Right. And the conditioning, you have to, when you look at it at the deepest level, where do most people get their definitions of what constitutes sane behavior? Well, they get that from their parents, friends, and coworkers, the exact people that have already bought into the meat and dairy marketing, most of them. And so when they are defining, when they look to define what constitutes sanity, which when you look at the facts that Joy Brown Melanie Joy lays out in her video, the carnism video, she makes it pretty clear that it's not a sane act at all for yourself animals, any of it, consuming meat. Yet all of the people that do that have gotten their definitions of what constitutes sanity from each other. And then they continue to support those definitions just through the conversations that they have. Day after day, they're doing the same thing, the same rote path, the same types of meals over and over again. So all of that doesn't help. And then, of course, you add on to that the fact that these foods are massively addictive and people get addicted to them at an early age. Dairy products, for example, latch onto the same receptors in the brain as do heroin and cocaine. So all of that, you combine it all, and it doesn't look good at all. Does it, Megan?
No, and you have to remember that the truth is well hidden. You're not meant to find it. You're not meant to discover what's going on. And I think with the onset of the internet, that has helped open up this truth and becoming, it's making people become aware because they're exposed to these truths, where prior to that, it wasn't as easily discovered. Yeah, you can discern right from birth, you trust your parents, they're looking after you, so why would you doubt, anything that they say as a child? They're responsible for your well-being, they're completely in front of you, eat it.
So give me an example. Your daughter has been, Megan, your daughter has been a vegan for her entire life, correct?
No, not for her entire life. She's 11. I've been vegan for almost 3 years now. So vegetarian for almost 10. So basically, yeah, I've been vegetarian. My children have been vegetarian and vegan with me for the last 3 years. When they go to their dad, they're vegan, so that makes it a little bit harder. Molly does stand up for what she believes in, but it must be difficult as a child to do that.
So we're talking. We're sitting. So we're. So we're sitting here. We're talking about how the system, the entire system. We've talked about this before. No matter what country we've been in, we have to go out of our way to. Find the vegan restaurants, the vegan options. It's 180 degrees backwards, and it's 180 degrees backwards in the United States. Just less than 100 years ago, you have to consider that 90% of your grocery stores were made up of produce and bags of grains and unprocessed foods. Now, that's reversed. Even in Whole Foods, an allegedly healthy food store, you go in there and you got 10 to 15% of your floor space at best that's dedicated to fresh produce, and the rest of the stuff is all boxed and may have a bit less poisonous ingredients than do your traditional food stores, but still, that's not a good sign, is it? When you got the absolute reverse going on, and we notice this in whatever country we go to. We're the vegans and we're the weirdos. We're the ones that have to be on guard for not having animal foods in our product, in our meals. Where was it we were eating, Megan, when we had to order a couple different times? That was in the Philippines. We ordered a salad, and it came with bacon bits and butter on bread and all of that stuff, and we had to tell them twice or three times that, vegan, no animal.
Parmesan cheese.
Yeah, that's right, parmesan cheese, right.
Yeah, I do recall, as a teenager, my younger sister refused to eat rabbit. They would eat chicken, but if they knew that my mother was cooking rabbit, because in Broken Hill country town, that was something that you ate, rabbit, lamb, goat, whatever. So, yeah, if they knew that the master was a rabbit, they would refuse to eat it. And there's that challenge, and they would happily eat it. So she takes back the chicken, and they eat it, and they love it.
Isn't it interesting how when you watch children or you watch people in different cultures, you know, some cultures a snail is considered a delicacy. It's just interesting when you watch different people and, you know, they consider some food, some animal foods food and other ones not. When it's all of it based upon our digestive makeup, our affinity for alkaline versus acidic foods. Essentially, eating a flesh food, we're not designed to consume any of that stuff. Yet people make these moral distinctions in their own minds of one animal is okay to eat and one isn't okay to eat. That reminds me of my brother and my father. They still go hunting. And I remember when my brother shot his first squirrel as a kid. This is just many years ago. And that squirrel went into our refrigerator, and then he found out that a squirrel is not that much different than a rat, and I think that squirrel stayed in the freezer for a couple of years. Its ghost is probably still trapped in that freezer. He never did get around to eating it, but although he did not consume that squirrel, he just went right on eating you know, all the standard meat dishes when one's really not that much different than the other. So, yeah, pretty disturbing. And, you know, we're talking about this. So what would you say, Megan, if you were to be talking to somebody and they were to say to you, your daughter's doing really well on a vegan diet, I'd like my family to go on a vegan diet also. What? Give me some tips that you would tell them, some action items that they could take home with them that would be of value.
So action items?
Yeah, what to do.
Oh, what to do?
You're going to be giving them a laundry list of things to do, so that their child can be more exposed and to a vegan lifestyle. Would you have them do it all overnight? Would you have them take it on incrementally? How would you go about that?
Okay, I'm going to try and think back to how I did it. For me, in the beginning, when I first became vegetarian, then it eliminated meat. I think I had fish for a little while, then I was vegetarian. I don't know if I suggest cutting things out, you know, in increments. I think it's so easy to live as a vegan for a while, but in your own home. Sticking to the healthy, natural, plant-based foods. There's soy milk coming around. There's just alternatives for anything. You don't need to be talking with cleaning animals.
I tend to agree with you on that, that the way of incrementally introducing somebody, a child or even an adult, to a vegan diet, I've never been a proponent of the idea that bringing it on incrementally works better than going cold turkey. Just based on my own experience 20 years ago, over 20 years ago now, when I read Anthony Robbins' book, Awaken the Giant Within, where he talks about the vegan diet. And then from there, I read Fit for Life by Harvey and Marilyn Diamond. I just cold turkey went vegan, and I never looked back. And it never bothered me, and I think I never suffered.
It's not like vegan, basically you're eating animal food. You're flavoring the animal anyway. Okay. Vegan food eliminates animals, and it's still tasty, right? If you're not eating animals, except for the animals.
I think what happens also is when you from my own experience, by going cold turkey and not eating any animal products, and then you increase the plant fiber that's going through your digestive tract, what happens is, as you clean that digestive tract out with fruit and vegetable fiber, a lot of your addictive poisons, animal products, drugs, and other foods that have become impacted onto the colon, all of that stuff starts coming out into the toilet from the plant fiber. So when you go cold, it sounds disgusting, but that's a fact. And when you go cold turkey, you get rid of that stuff quickly. Whereas if you, the people that I've worked with that have tried to drag it out and say, well, I'm going to have a little bit of meat here, I'm going to, you know, maybe have it once or twice a week, it tends to keep those addictive toxins, it tends to keep feeding that addiction rather than scrubbing it out. So to me, it makes a lot more sense to go cold turkey on it. And also, there are a lot more available vegan options for kids and people that are new to it, many of which that you would be hard-pressed to tell the difference between an actual product and an animal and the vegan product. I know those Boca burgers, I have tasted those before, and those are really good. I don't eat them now because I don't subscribe. I pretty much stick to a fruit and vegetable diet, but I can tell you when I tasted one of those, it was very good.
I mean, any standard meat-based dish can be replicated and taste just as good, if not better, because it all depends on the seasoning you use, the base product of the meat doesn't really come into it. That's just what I feel. So you can replicate any vegan meal. It's so easy, and I wish this was taught in schools. You know, like, if kids were made aware of what is actually going on and what they're eating, wouldn't the world be a better place? But my daughter is, there's another girl in her class who's vegetarian, but that's it. There's probably Molly and this girl are the only ones maybe in the year. It's just so hard for us to find vegan children in schools. And wouldn't it be great if this was actually promoted and people knew the truth?
Yeah, not if the meat and dairy lobbies have anything to do with how these schools.
It's just so frustrating.
That being said, I did read a story. I can't remember who sent it to me on Facebook. I'll dig it up for next week, though. Maybe we can continue. We're getting down to the last 10 or 15 minutes. Is that right, Ruthann?
Yeah, we have 12 minutes left.
Yeah, okay. Well, next week maybe we can get into this a little bit more, but somebody sent me a story of a school teacher that had the guts to take her, I believe it was 10 or 12-year-old students to a slaughterhouse.
Oh, yeah.
And, hey, you know, at first I thought that might be a little extreme, and then I'm thinking, you know what, hey, may not be such a bad idea. If I were to write out an action list of how to develop a child's nervous system, I tend to agree with Anthony Robbins in his assessment that, you know, human beings are driven by pain and pleasure, and like it or not, it is the painful experiences in your life more often than not that lead to a change in your behavior. And for these kids, a lot of them came out in tears after witnessing what they saw in a slaughterhouse. I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and guess that they may not look at a burger in the same way as they would have before they walked in there. Whereas I could have told them all the benefits of a plant-based diet. You're going to get this, this, and this. You're not going to get cancer. And in their brains, they're going, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's 30 years. These kids are not even conscious at that age. However, when you introduce them to a painful stimulus, like taking them to a slaughterhouse, that drastically affects their nervous system at a deep level. It's like scratching a record when they try to play that record back and look at that meat in the same way as they did before they went into that slaughterhouse. It'll never play the same way again.
Yeah, I actually have a distant cousin who did just that here in Australia. She took her children, both under 10, to a piggery, and they actually did see the pigs being slaughtered.
Yeah, may not be such a bad idea when you look at all of that. And
I guess it's perspective.
And Ruth Ann was just mentioning, I don't know if you heard, Megan, you may have been doing something in the other room. Ruth Ann was mentioning to me this 269 case. Can you give me, can you run down that really quick, what that was, Ruth Ann?
Well, in May, three Israeli animal activists did a public display or demonstration of having themselves chained and put in a cage. And then they were each taken out and branded with the number 269, which was what they had discovered on a calf that they had visited earlier. They had been in some type of a farm. So now this has become a movement, and many people are being tattooed on their wrist with the 269. Like, this is an animal holocaust. And they're on Facebook, 269 Live, with no separation between the number and the words. So look them up,
Errol.
Like, they also have a website, but I can't tell you for sure what it is. I don't have it handy.
Yeah, I think they're, if you go to their Facebook page, which is 269 Life, and enter that in the Facebook toolbar, it'll take you to the page. I think they're, from there you can access the videos and a lot of their material. And again, when you look at it, I like the idea, of course, everybody is not going to go out and get branded. That's not the point. The point is that they are taking some proactive element of action here. In other words, they're not just talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. They went and they actually, you know, had the audacity to go through the pain to do this. It's the taking of the action. And even taking a small action, you may not think something like, well, you know, that's all great, but is me getting a tattoo going to make any difference? Maybe. It very well may be. Because even a small action
of something about it.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I'm a big believer in the idea that small actions can affect the entire, can affect a ripple in the pool, if you will, of human consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's been an idea that's been with humanity for eons. And I still believe in that. I still believe in the 100th monkey phenomenon, where you've got 100 monkeys, and when it reaches a point of critical mass of monkeys peeling potatoes on one island, all of a sudden, when it reaches a certain critical mass, monkeys on other islands with no physical connection to the ones that started peeling potatoes start doing the same. So the point of that is that there very well may be a fabric that connects all of human consciousness as one. I certainly believe that there is.
Yes.
And when you take an action, like these three people did, that Ruthann was talking about, and when you take an action such as getting a tattoo, and then, yes, maybe somebody asks you about it, that may affect them in far-reaching ways that you don't realize upon getting that tattoo, right? Yeah, let's hope so. A step in the right direction. So what do we got here? Let's just kind of recap. We talked a little bit in the beginning of the show about the sandal clad running. I'm going to go ahead and pick up maybe a better pair of the shower shoes style, and we'll try that this week, and we'll report back on that next week. We talked about the massive chasm between what people are putting into their mouths, animal foods, and the chasm between what they think they're putting into their mouths and what it really is, and which is not a good thing. And then we did get a little bit into the solutions on that, which are, keep that type of stuff away from your children. I think it's better to go cold turkey, especially given all the vegan options that are available today. It's a great time to become a vegan, better than at any point in human history, I'd say. Also, I think it's very important, as we indicated here, that we just got into it a little bit, is to break that conditioning that children are exposed to at an early age. And things like the teacher did that we talked about, taking children to a slaughterhouse, that may be extreme, but hey, how about showing them when they're old enough something like Food, Inc. or Earthlings? That's a step back from a slaughterhouse, but I guarantee it's an experience that will affect a child's nervous system to possibly make a distinction or two that they would not make if you just told them how great the vegan diet is. It's a much more immediate, impacting, emotional experience when you see what's going on. So I'm actually for that. And then we talked a little bit about if you go cold turkey, I think it's the way to go because you cleanse your digestive tract out and you get all those addictive toxins out. Would you add anything else to that, Megan?
No. By saying cold turkey, to me, that sounds like really hard. Whereas I don't think it is. Well, for me, it wasn't really hard because I became vegan for ethical reasons, whereas you know, you became vegan for health reasons. Because there's ethical, for me, it's easy.
Yeah, it was easy for me, too. It was easy for me, too, for the reasons that we talked about, the cleansing of the digestive tract, the getting rid of the addictive poisons, all of that. I think you're right, though. The term cold turkey, we've got to come up with something better than that. I think just the idea of quitting altogether may be a more appropriate thing for humanity and turkey alike.
Like the same children who expose them to slaughter. You know, like I exposed myself to all of that, but you were coming from an adequate point of view. You weren't seeing that. It was more. So it's really a difference, I think, in the way that you can feel and find it in the thought process.
Okay.
It was to see that it's
not. Yes. We're going to have to cut it short here. I'd like to continue on here, but we're running low on time. So we'll continue with a little bit of this at the beginning of next week's show, and then we'll get into Mike Adams' article next week, Everything is Rigged, Health, Politics, Finance, and More, but Here's How to Beat the System. We'll get into a little bit of that subject matter next week. And with that, let's go ahead and close it up. Any last-minute thoughts, Ruth Ann?
No, I think you got a lot covered today. So that's great. And I'm going to watch the lady on YouTube, Melanie Joy.
Yes, that'd be great. So next week you can tell us what you thought of Melanie Joy's speech, and we'll pick up right where we left off here. That should then we'll get into Mike Adams' piece, and we'll have some other good stuff too. So. Thanks for the time here, Ruth Ann, and thanks for all of your input, Megan. That was great.
So we'll see you next week.
Okay, see you next week.